It's Friday, December 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello and Merry Christmas. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Afghan officials say they have advanced on a Taliban stronghold.
This 1.5% budget increase is not much more than a natural increase.
An increase in Japan's military budget may not actually be large. We look at China's slowing economy and its impact in 2016. Also ahead, Dolly Parton embarks on a series of television specials. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. Officials in Afghanistan say national forces backed by U.S. airstrikes have regained control of a key district in the southern province of Helmand from Taliban militants. A U.S. military spokesman, Colonel Michael Lawhorn, confirmed to VOA that U.S. aircraft participated in the fighting in the Sangin district. Colonel Lawhorn spoke with International Edition's Ira Melman about the latest developments in Afghanistan's Taliban insurgency.
What is happening, the most importantly, is that the Afghans are the ones doing the fighting. I know there's been a lot of attention on it this week. Helmand province as a whole remains a very contested area. We've said that. We knew that this was going to be difficult throughout this year. Helmand is the main effort for the Afghan security forces. But our mission has not changed. We continue to train, advise, and assist our Afghan partners. And the Afghans are the ones that are doing the fighting in and around Sangin.
Why is Helmand so important to NATO and the combined forces and also to the Taliban?
Well, it's the traditional homeland of the Taliban. The Taliban have also made that their main effort. They have a large presence down there. And they have said for years their plan is to try to take over Helmand, and Sangin is one of the smaller provinces, but it's important to their overall effort because of where it's located. Sangin is just north of a major highway that cuts east-west across the Helmand province, and it sits on a major north-south highway. So it's both tactically important from the area that it controls, that large intersection of the two main highways that intersect in Helmand province, and also spiritually and emotionally significant to the Taliban.
What about financially as far as the poppy crop is concerned?
Well, that's obviously one of the main sources of income for the various Taliban groups. And interestingly enough, that's one of the areas in which we see a lot of the conflict between the various Taliban groups in Afghanistan and the Daesh, what we could refer to as Daesh, or the ISIS groups that are trying to make headway. They're fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan right now, and a lot of that conflict has to do with control of poppies, control of the opium, control of organized crime in and around Afghanistan as a source of fundraising for the various insurgent groups. One of the things that's important to remember, a lot of these guys who are in these groups, probably 70 to 90% of them have been in one or more previous groups over the course of the last years. A lot of times you'll see these guys change their T-shirts, if you will. They get disaffected, disenfranchised with a certain group. They feel they might have more success joining a different group, and they move back and forth. So that's one of the things that makes it kind of hard to estimate the numbers of any particular group at any given time. But what we're seeing is a lot of conflict between Daesh, between the various Taliban groups here, and the Afghan National Army is busy fighting both of them as well.
And how are they doing?
We've seen a lot of improvement. Is it where we'd like it to be right now? It's probably not where we want it to be in the future. There's still a lot of areas for improvement, and we have some things in the works to help improve that. Early next year, you'll see the Afghans get their first delivery of fixed-wing aircraft. They're pilots that have been just graduated from training back in the United States. Afghan pilots are going to come here. They're going to start employing fixed-wing aircraft to do close air support with Afghan forces. They've done a really good job of improving the way they integrate their own helicopter. We have a new helicopter called the MD-530. It's a light helicopter armed with machine guns and some rockets, and they're able to do close air support on their own. And most importantly, they have kept the Taliban from making any strategic gains anywhere in Afghanistan in 2015.
U.S. military spokesman Colonel Michael Lawhorn speaking with International Edition's Ira Melman. Well, we wanted to check out what was the reaction on social media to the latest developments in Afghanistan. A lot of posts out there talking about what was happening in Sangin. One that reads, Afghanistan, dozens of Taliban killed in battle for Sangin, a local Taliban commander, and 50 fighters killed. Fox News tweets, is the Taliban regaining the upper hand in Afghanistan? A thoughtful piece about what is happening there at the moment. Afghan troops rushed to area under Taliban attack. That, a news item from Kabul, also being widely tweeted. Afghanistan's fight for Sangin, a key psychological battle for both sides. There were a series of unconfirmed tweets that have been circulating around. Unidentified helicopters dropping off Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan. That, of course, another name for Islamic State fighters. And as Colonel Lawhorn had alluded to in that report we just heard with Ira Melman. Some interesting interaction on Twitter between nations. The official Twitter account of Turkey's presidency, at TR Presidency, tweets, we endeavor to further strengthen our unshakable ties with Afghanistan. And then Xinhua News, at XH News, tweets, Turkey is the real face of USA policy, terroristic. The occupation of Afghanistan is also against China, in addition to oil routes. Also trending on the topic, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is arriving in Kabul to inaugurate the Afghan parliament that was built by India, that happening later in the day. And also new details on the recent attack in Afghanistan that killed six U.S. Air Force personnel. Our social media guru is G. Abby Lee. She has had the week off, but she will be back next week. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. Our International Edition Twitter account is at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us, free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar at voanews.com, and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Japan's cabinet on Thursday approved a 1.5% hike in defense spending for the fiscal year that begins in April, bringing outlays to a record of more than $41 billion, driven by costs involving a controversial U.S. base relocation, also personnel expenses, as Japan experiences a defense buildup under Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. It now goes on to Parliament. The budget debate comes as Japan this week spotted its a Chinese Coast Guard vessel near uninhabited and disputed islands in the East China Sea that appeared to be armed with cannon-like equipment. Japan administers the islands it calls the Senkakus, while China claims them and refers to them as the Diaoyus. Security analyst Yoichiro Sato of Ritsumeikan Asia Pacific University tells VOA's Victor Beatty the island dispute has no direct impact on the budget.
In the long term, Japan has been shifting more money toward, for example, acquisition of new submarines. But this is not limited to this particular year, but rather the planned procurement for the next 5 years or so, which is driven partially by the concern about China's recent behavior in East Asia.
There's no question, though, that the budget is growing under the prime minister. Obviously, he has priorities, and China may be one of them.
China is indeed a major concern for Japan. But you have to put this budget increase in context, because 1.5% is a small increase, especially now that Abe has jump-started the economy with target inflation rate of 2%. So although Japan is not going to achieve a 2% inflation rate, the GDP has been growing, and so is the tax revenue. So in that sense, this 1.5% budget increase is not much more than a natural increase.
The Chinese apparently sent a Coast Guard vessel to the disputed islands in the East China Sea that apparently had a cannon on it, and that caused quite a stir in Japan.
Yes, the Chinese maritime patrol boats have been very actively entering the contiguous zones around Senkaku Island. But the Coast Guard has been also patrolling this area. So far, this is more of a political show for domestic consumption rather than actual attempt to prepare any kind of landing activities. So for now, the tension between Japan and China over the Senkaku Island is lower compared to, say, 2 years ago.
There have been increasing contacts between Japanese and Chinese officials. Is that part of the easing of tensions?
Yes, they have been talking about the possibility of discussing the kind of crisis prevention mechanism. The general mood between the two countries is that they will move on with economic cooperation, which involves not only Japan, China, but also Korea. The political mood has been quite dominant in the last couple of months.
Prime Minister Abe gained cabinet approval last year to allow Japan to participate in collective self-defense, allowing Japan's armed forces to rescue foreign troops or UN personnel conducting peacekeeping operations if attacked. Yoichiro Sato says public opinion in Japan still strongly opposes any change to the war renouncing Article 9 of the country's post-war constitution. As 2015 draws to a close, China's slowing economy is affecting the world in larger ways. As seen earlier in the year during the Asian financial crisis and with the subsequent devaluation of China's currency, the renminbi. New York University professor and China economics expert Ann Lee joins us to assess where China's economy is heading in the coming year.
Certainly, the slowdown in Europe and the U.S. has probably accelerated certain plans the Chinese had anyway. These things were goals that they had set out that they were probably going to try to meet, but given the accelerated slowdowns in Europe and then in the U.S., Chinese leaders were basically saying, well, it would make sense to ask folks to provide tax incentives and other areas, other forms of policy tools to increase investments. So that was basically what I was suggesting, that it's a little bit of both something internal and external going on, and it's not necessarily bad news for the world.
You've written about Beijing's efforts to grow the middle class. Are increased wages helping to boost the internal market economy?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're on track to continue to lift more people out of poverty as long as their economy continues to grow. And the indicators for consumption growth and income growth seem to be accelerating. So I think that this is good news for both China in terms of, you know, creating more stability if they have a larger middle class, and good news for the rest of the world so that you have basically expanding demand around the world. And this can only be good news for a lot of private companies when they are trying to make decisions on whether they're going to start a company or start a new product line. If they know that there are more customers on the other end, they're more likely to make those investments.
The latest Asia-Pacific Wealth Report indicates that Asia's wealthy now outnumbers those here in North America. What factors are involved in this shift?
I am certain that it's because there are more and more people being able to create more private companies to generate their own profits and then become wealthy that way. Remember, 30 years ago, this whole nation was state-owned, so everything was state-owned enterprises. There were no such thing as private companies. And now the private sector is, roughly half of the economy, and the other half is still state-owned. But I think this trend towards more privatization will continue. And it's already also outlined in a five-year plan that they want to introduce more competition in certain industries. And so I think when they do that, that just creates a wealth of opportunity for individuals to create businesses and make a lot of money.
Ann Lee is an internationally recognized leading authority on China's economic relations. She's the author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China, and she's also an adjunct professor of economics and finance at New York University. Ann, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
A new television movie looks at a significant moment in country singer Dolly Parton's childhood. International Edition's Sarah Williams speaks about it with Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong.
Many inspiring stories of faith and family come to life on the small screen. One of those TV movies includes the story of one of country music's icons, Dolly Parton. Her new film, Coat of Many Colors, is a snapshot of her life as a 9-year-old girl overcoming a family tragedy while living in poverty in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee in 1955. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here with more details. Well, Nikki, this movie, Coat of Many Colors, is actually based on Dolly Parton's signature hit of the same name.
Yes, and Dolly Parton says that the song is one of her, actually her favorite song that she has ever written. It was released in October 1971 from the album of the same name. And the song itself tells a story of how her mom stitched together a coat for Dolly made out of rags that were given to her family. And as she sewed the coat, her mom would share the biblical story of Joseph and his coat of many colors, in which his father Jacob or Israel gave Joseph this fancy coat as a gift because Joseph was his favorite son. And Joseph, like Dolly, is also one out of 12 children. However, when Dolly wore this coat to school, she was ridiculed and teased about it. But by the end of the song, she realizes that despite being poor, according to the world standards, that coat was far richer than all the material gain in the world. Now, in the movie, we get a deeper meaning behind the song. Dolly has never been ashamed of where she's come from. Her dad and her mom married as teenagers. They were dirt poor. Her dad never had a chance to go to school, but he was a hard worker. And she says her mom had a faith that would move mountains and a love for her dad that just would not quit. And Dolly says that her mother would give each of her siblings a baby. You know, this is your baby, meaning you'll take care of him, you'll feed him, you'll change the diapers. Well, the baby that was supposed to be Dolly's dies. Aww. And her mother goes into a deep depression. And then during this time is when she makes the coat for Dolly. And so the coat then becomes symbolic of stitching the pieces of life back together after this loss. And once Dolly starts getting teased for wearing it, it also becomes a means of personal transformation as little Dolly learns to determine her own self-worth versus anchoring her worth in the shallow opinions of others. So the coat really becomes an anchor in the film, signifying resiliency, renewal, faith, and most importantly, love.
So tell us about the cast. Dolly Parton handpicked many of the actors.
Yeah, Dolly picked Ricky Schroeder to play her father. She said he reminded her so much of her father. She said he looks like his people, his body structure. And Ricky Schroeder and his wife actually lost a child too. So doing the film really hit home for his family as well. Country music star Jennifer Nettles plays her mom. I was surprised by this too. Dolly says Jennifer sent her an audition tape and she flipped out. She said when she heard Jennifer reading the role, she thought, oh my Lord, that's mama. And she said that people are going to be blown away by Jennifer's performance. Olivia Lynn plays Dolly as a child, and she was chosen out of hundreds of children. And Dolly's sister is in it, too. She plays the church lady who brings the rags to make the coat. You can actually take a look at a lengthy preview of it on our Facebook page. You can just go to VOA Music, and you can get a sneak peek there.
This film is also the first in a series Dolly Parton is doing with NBC.
Yeah, it is. Coat of Many Colors is the first in a series of movies Dolly is making. Jolene, based on her 1974 hit, will be the next film.
I love that song.
Oh, my God. Very different story. That's going to be juicy. I can't wait.
You can hear music from Dolly Parton and many other country music artists on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong. You can also reach Nikki on Twitter at @VOA_music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks, Nikki.
Thank you.
There were rags of many colors, but every piece was small, and I didn't have a coat, and it was way down in the fall. Mama sewed the rags together, so in every piece with love, she made my coat of many colors.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, and we're also out there on Twitter, at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zeynep Abdel-Rahman. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington, and I wish you a very Merry Christmas. Whether or not you observe the holiday, I hope that all that is good in the essence of Christmas is with you today and throughout the coming year. Hope you have a wonderful day. Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
In a popular American short story, a young couple, poor but very much in love, frets over what to give each other for Christmas. To buy her husband Jim a chain for his proudest possession, a gold pocket watch, Della sells her proudest possession, her long brown hair, to be made into a wig. Jim finds Della a fine pair of hair combs, but he can pay for them only by trading away his watch. When they exchange gifts and realize what they've done, their now useless presents are all the more precious because of the love and sacrifice they represent. The holiday of Christmas, which millions of Americans and others around the world celebrate today, has inspired many such tales. Some deal with the lessons of generosity and hope, others with the value of friendship, family, and faith. Oddly, one of the most famous, A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, is essentially a ghost story. What they have in common is a spirit of redemption and rejoicing that has long touched the human heart. Tradition is as much a part of the holiday as is its spirit. As in much of the world, millions of Americans will exchange gifts, worship together in their various ways, then gather perhaps with family and friends to complete the celebration over dinner. Many will volunteer to help the homeless, hungry, and others in need. These sentiments transcend nationality, however, and even religion. As the world gets smaller, the Christmas spirit is seen in many places, from Europe to Africa and even Asia. In Japan, Christmas is known more as a time to spread happiness rather than as a religious celebration. Presents and cards are exchanged, and parties are often held for children, with games and dancing. In Madagascar, an island nation off the east coast of Africa, it's summer at Christmas time, but even though it's hot, many homes are decorated in the spirit of the season with holly and imitation snow, even though none of them exist there. The message of peace on earth and goodwill toward men is universal, and one that Americans wish to share at this time of year with all citizens of the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.